Welcome to The Conversation. My name is Graham Nystrom, and I'm your host today. This is KMUN's live call-in show, and the number is 503-325-0010. Today's topic is racism, white privilege, defunding the police, Black Lives Matter, protests, counter-protests, and as always, COVID-19. Give us a call and check in. Let us know what your thoughts are. I've got a couple ideas to get things started, and I've got a couple more recordings from local protests that were recorded by our program director, Emily. So thanks to everyone who is showing up to these protests and making their voices heard, taking a stand, showing solidarity. But at some point, this is going to have to turn into real action and real change. How do we do it? I've seen the term defund the police thrown around constantly, and I've seen various reactions to it. Facebook is a terrible place to get your information, by the way. We've got our first caller coming in, so let me get some stuff transferring here. Caller number one, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I believe it's very much time for us to demilitarize our police. They are armed against citizens, but not just Black people and brown people, but all of us. They carry 40 more pounds of weight around with them at all times now when they're answering any calls. They don't need to have military equipment. We need to change the term defund, because everybody thinks it means taking money all away. We just need the money to go to taking care of crimes and put the other money towards social help for people.
Yeah, mental health.
Yes, mental health.
Addiction.
They shouldn't be out there answering calls for people that have mental health issues. So many mental health people have been killed by the police because they don't understand what they're doing, so they just shoot first. So we just need to change the way we allocate the money that goes to the police.
I've seen a quote here that says, defund is not abolish. Remember that for every single thing that goes wrong, a mental health crisis, a runaway dog, a domestic dispute, there just might be a better person to bring in than a cop, like, say, a mental health expert, a dog catcher, or a trained social worker. But those have no funding. So defunding means reinvesting. I like having cops generally, but we ask too much of them. That's Jim in Portland. Well, any other comments for us today? I appreciate your input.
No, that's all.
Okay, thanks for the call. Mm-hmm. Next caller, you're on the air. Hi, go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for having this show. I listen to it every week. But this is my first time to call. I've been very lucky. I was able to participate. And I keep calling them demonstrations. I think that's my age. But the protests, which are thrilling because of the youth and because of the mixture of different people. As far as the police, I think that it is not that it's right. We don't want to get rid of all the police. I don't think we do. I think we want to change how the funding is used for the police and the mindset of what their jobs are, and to help them by providing them with resources, like a lot more people who are educated and taught how to deal with family disputes, for the people who have mental problems that are going crazy. They don't need to deal with that, and they're not really trained to, even though I think a lot of the police are joined because they want to help. That's where I'm at.
Well, I think the police serve a very specific purpose, and when you try to bend that purpose into every possible direction, like that first quote I read said, we're just asking too much of the police.
Yes, yeah, we are.
The police should not be the ones charged with solving the homelessness problem, is a really good example.
I agree. They also, many years ago, I lived in Houston, Texas. And that was back in the late 60s, very early 70s. And then the police there were very violent and very ignorant in how they dealt with the gay situation, as well as sexual abuse and how they dealt with women. There was investigations being done by the local newspaper on that, but they weren't being provided with training. That was also in 70 or 71, was the first time that the social services, like child welfare, was not the responsibility of the police department, which took away funding and didn't replace it with other types of funding. So there was a lot of anger the police had towards the new people coming in, the new social workers, and how to cooperate and work together. That's what I'm hoping doesn't happen with this change. And I do think we're going to have a change. This is exciting.
Agreed. Thank you for your call.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Next caller, you're on the air.
Oh, is that me?
That's you. Go ahead.
All right. This is Anthony. Say, I want to talk about white privilege. More of an observation than an actual involvement, okay?
Please do.
There were a number of protests at state capitals with mostly white men who were called themselves patriots. And they had all their insignias and paraphernalia and guns and rockets and language and all the stuff that would frighten some folks. And I was just thinking, what if natives showed up with, you know, war gear and bows and arrows and on ponies and painted, or you know, some brown people from Southern California showed up with bandoleros and rifles and sombreros, or even worse, maybe a Black Panther paraphernalia with, you know, rifles and berets. I wonder what the outcome would have been in those different situations in this country. I'm quite afraid that it might not have worked out the way the white privileged patriots, which at some level you might even be able to call them terrorists, would look at that situation and see their own white privilege. It's kind of an interesting situation.
It's really hard to see it.
And you know, and some of the media,
for some people,
almost all the corporate media wouldn't point that out as being white privilege. They sort of stay away from that kind of privilege that us white men have when we put on our paraphernalia and gear and run around and do the things that we think are right. Anyway, this is my comment on one aspect of white privilege that's never really talked about.
We got to get past it.
Thanks for your show.
Thank you, Anthony.
Take care.
You too. Bye. Bye. Next caller, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello?
Hello. Go ahead, please.
Steve.
Hi, Steve.
Hi. I think what we need are positive programs, and I think that's where the emphasis should be. And what I mean is, you know, we've always had, you know, good, enriched education in the suburbs, in the areas that are not inner city. I'm a retired U.S. historian, and I've looked at the urban situation for many years. And the inner city, if you go back to the 60s and the uprisings that occurred then, we really haven't solved the problems that were there then. There's an over-reliance on police in inner city. There is not an adequate infrastructure for solving the real and growing problems there. The Scandinavians have had, forever, something they call an ombudsman, which represents, it's an individual who's trained, represents the community. This particular community certainly needs representation, represents them in the legislature, represents them with the governor. So you have continuous input from people affected by not only harsh policing, but just by the conditions of life. We put a huge amount of money into defense expenditure, for example, and a lot of things that could easily be pared down, and we've allowed the infrastructure, the social infrastructure, the economic infrastructure, a bunch of the infrastructure of this country to decline over the past several decades. And we need to have much, much more emphasis on building that up. And the inner city is sort of like the canary in the coal mine. The inner city has been, for a very, very long time, in a deteriorating state. You know, you've got those ancient programs back in the 60s carried on by people like Robert Moses in New York that kind of removed minorities in order to rebuild. And the minorities would always be removed to whatever neighborhood was run down. And this is the situation that still goes on as our entire domestic infrastructure deteriorates, and we still concentrate on putting troops around the world and doing things that are unnecessary and that lead to all the wrong things. So I'll stop there.
Thank you for your call, Steve.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. If you're just tuning in, this is The Conversation on Coast Community Radio. This is our live call-in show, and the number is 503-325-0010. Please give us a call and weigh in with your thoughts on the Black Lives Matter movement, the protests, institutional racism, and defunding the police. What does it mean to you? It's a tough question to answer, but I think it's worth looking for the answer and not just reacting to the term defund the police. A story on Medium.com by Jamie Mulligan says, I'm seeing a lot of white people critique the phrase defund the police while saying that they agree with looking at how much our society decides to allocate to police and budgets. I've seen an argument, we need to be clear that when you make these comments about branding, what you're suggesting is that black activists leading this movement should be shaping their messaging to what white people are comfortable with, something that won't turn the white people off. The reality is that if black activists stuck to messaging that white people felt comfortable with, they would have to stop saying anything, because we white people are fragile on these issues. Using the phrase defund the police is exactly how you design an effective campaign around this issue, given the cultural context. Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, so my name's Jack, and I just call him to say that I think we need to realize that it starts at the top. And back in the 80s, Reagan cut the mental health hospitals and the budgets for that and put money into defense and the police. And I don't want to make this a political situation, I mean, but if you look at it, the Democrats will more or less fund social programs, and the Republicans always want to keep the money for corporations or for policing or anything like that. So our current occupant of the White House is definitely a racist. If anybody can't see that, then they're blind. And it starts at the top. I guess that's basically the thing. You know, us as individuals, as citizens, can only do so much individually. We can vote, maybe, if the lines aren't too long. Here in Oregon, thank God, we vote by mail. But it's got to start at the top. If you don't hear the wind's not blowing in the right direction from the top, then it's never going to change. We're always going to hear different racist comments coming from the Washington, D.C., and that's just super destructive. So that's about all I had to say. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the reminder about where funding went during the Reagan administration towards mental health. I think that that's just an immediate problem that we could solve, is by restoring that funding. What programs were in place before the Reagan era that we can resume? Why not? There's plenty of money out there. There's plenty of money out there. Let's spend it in the right way. 503-325-0010. We've got three open phone lines. If you're calling in and you're having trouble getting through, try back. We're putting you on hold immediately, and you'll just be in the queue until you hear from me. So be patient with our skeleton crew that we're operating the station and the show with. We're doing our best, and we sure appreciate your input. So again, give us a call, 503-325-0010. What are your ideas or your reactions to the protests, to the Black Lives Matter movement? There's a call. You're on the air. Hi, go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to follow on the the last caller, when he talked about defunding mental health, there was also a connection, a direct connection with that defunding, which was the rise in homelessness. And
of course, yeah.
That started even before Reagan became president in the 80s. When he was governor in California, he did the same thing. And people who have expertise on homelessness will tell you there's a direct line between mental health care and the rise in homelessness.
And there's no way that police can also provide mental health care.
No, that's not their gig. But, you know, the thing about just a comment on defunding police, it's, in my opinion, too broad a brush, and there isn't a group per se or individual leader to define what it means. So in terms of the culture, it's out there as something that's not making a lot of sense yet because people don't exactly know what it means. And of course, their first reaction is going to be worry that they're going to they won't be as protected as they want to be when they see something like defunding. So I think the concept needs better articulation and a political group or infrastructure to move it along. Be interesting to see what a city like L.A. does with its recent move to defund to pull back a significant amount of money from policing. If it's a quid pro quo of it goes from police to mental health, that would be one approach, or the Minneapolis approach, where they're essentially dismantling their entire police structure and rebuilding it from scratch.
You struck a chord when you said the word leadership, because who is rising to the top of this mess with the clear message that everyone can get behind? I think that leadership is really important, and I have yet to see that show up. It's still chaos.
Yeah, you know, it'll probably happen on a smaller scale first. I haven't heard, even if you were to round up all the Democrat candidates for president, I haven't heard much from them on the topic. And obviously, the current resident of the White House is going to be resistant to all of this in an effort to please his 40%.
Well, John, thanks for the call.
You bet. See ya.
We miss you around here.
Thanks.
Bye. Next caller, you're on the air. Hi, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I was just calling because one of the things I wanted to bring up that a lot of people have been talking about is how this seems like an extreme response, or it seems very sudden or things like that. But this is something that Black and Brown activists have been working on for years. Like, there are people who have great ideas and great solutions in place when they say things like defund the police, because the police are just one part of just a massive structure that is designed to, like, uphold racism in the United States. So when we talk about things like this defund the police seems very sudden, it's really discounting the work that's been done years before that's just now kind of getting mainstream. So I just want to remind people that all this has been happening for a long time, whether or not you've been aware of it, and just encourage people to really seek out the voices for, like, the front runners of the Black Lives Matter movement, people who have been studying white supremacy and racial justice, especially things like with The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander. Like, that's required reading for seeing how the police can act to enforce this new racial structure that we've put in place. And I just think that people need to remember that this is not a surprise. This is not sudden. Just because it's sudden and new to you does not necessarily mean that it is new to people who have been working on this for decades.
I think it's really important for people to acknowledge the need to feel uncomfortable right now.
Definitely.
I've felt like I've been punched in the gut since this whole thing started. And as challenging as that is, I still welcome it in a way because it's kind of the least I can do apart from our role here at the radio station. So that was The New Jim Crow by who?
That's by Michelle Alexander, and it is fantastic reading. It really lays out how things like the war on drugs and the increase in the presence of police was enacted as a response to the civil rights movement, of how to, like, continue upholding racist structures in the U.S. And there's tons of literature out there. Like, I definitely encourage everybody to reach out and find Black voices and Black scholars who have been working on this and have great examples of where we've gone wrong and where we can fix it.
I spoke with a police officer a few nights ago, and he was justifiably worried about, for example, if he has to respond to a call and they get less funding, does that mean there are fewer people on duty and his backup is farther away or unavailable? And so, you know, I would happily say, you know, responding to criminality is absolutely what we need a full staff of police for. It's responding to non-criminality that we need other services for. And if there is excess funding due to the militarization of police departments, or like I said earlier, just the expectation that they fulfill duties that are much too much to ask of them, then I think we can come up with something better. Do you have any other thoughts for us today? I really appreciate your call.
So I'm not an expert. I'm just a person who like tries to listen and learn, and I'm just encouraging everybody to reach out and do the same. Keep an open mind, seek out good sources, and don't, just because it's a surprise to you doesn't mean it's a surprise to everybody. So.
Great. Thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Next caller, you're on the air. Hi, go ahead.
Hi, this is Victoria. Thinking about something, I was in Berkeley in the late 60s when a lot of stuff was happening, a lot of anti-war activity. And the free speech movement grew out of people coming back to school who had worked in the South to help people register to vote. But anyway, the presence of police has really changed a lot. During the height of the Vietnam War protests, quote unquote, the police weren't like armored cars, you know. Individual police officers, you could see their faces, you could see their badges, and so on. One of the things that has happened is that the U.S. military, when they have obsolete equipment, they attempt to sell it at bargain basement prices to local police forces. And one of the things I want to point out is that that is a decision of the local police whether or not to take on all this military gear. Flint Wright has been the chief of police for Long Beach, Washington, and therefore that's a police force for most of the Long Beach Peninsula. And some years back, I can't remember how long it was, he was very public about, nope, I'm not taking any of that gear. It just scares people. We don't need it. We don't need to police in our small communities with armored cars and machine guns and all this stuff that the military wanted to offload to our local communities. So part of what's happened is the reason our police in cities now look so much more like the military is the military has been outfitting them with gear that the military didn't want anymore. And that's a strange conundrum. And Flint was very forthright and I think acted with some courage in just deciding that his force wasn't going to go that route. So, and that's the end of my call. And glad you're doing this. Take care.
Thanks, Victoria.
Bye.
Okay, next caller, you're on the air. Go ahead. Hello, you're on the air. Go ahead. Hello, you're on the air. Go ahead. Are you there? Hello? Well, that was uneventful. 5 minutes left in the show. You're listening to The Conversation on KMUN, and we are talking about the Black Lives Matter movement. One thing that I've been struggling to come to terms with in my head is the phrase Black Lives Matter. To me, that seems like such an understatement, such a gross understatement of what any human life is worth. It's worth so much more than just mattering. So I struggle a little bit with that. We've got that caller calling back. Hi there, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi there. I just wanted to say that to all my community in Astoria that it's really important to keep showing up in the ways that we can. Protests everywhere build momentum for nationwide movements. Already, we've seen that abolition has gone from kind of a far-out idea to a real possibility in many American cities. And it's arguably even more important to show up when you're living in a small town like we do. Solidarity really, really matters, and the numbers are just smaller. So keep showing up in all the ways that you can, whether that's, you know, physically at a protest, donating money, you know, donating your time. And make sure you're always listening to the Black and POC leaders for direction. We can truly make change, and really now is more important than ever. So if you haven't come out yet, it's really not too late. So I just want to encourage everybody to show up and keep working.
Absolutely. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Bye. I mentioned earlier that we have a couple of recordings from some of the protests that happened last weekend. And to finish my thought about Black Lives Matter, I remember a piece of stand-up comedy from Jamie Foxx, who was trying to lift up Black people. And he said so many things that were profound about African Americans and Black people. And I believe that he started with Black is beautiful. And so to me, Black Lives Matter, like, that's just above the zero point. And that's, it's just sad that that's where we have to begin, and that people still disagree with that. Because Black is beautiful, Black is powerful, Black is graceful, Black is music, Black is soul, Black is dance. Jamie Foxx, Black is beautiful. Black lives more, so much more than just matter to me. And that does go for everyone. 503-325-0010, just a couple more minutes in the hour. Let's hear from Jordan in Astoria, recorded last Saturday at a protest.
My name is Jordan, and I'm from here.
Sorry.
And what are you here to say today?
I think it's good to say enough is enough as far as police brutality and structural racism goes. And I think it's also about time we start looking at the way that we live in this country and what our role is. I think another conversation that I want to start having soon, when the time is right and when, you know, it won't be distracting from this, is what is our relationship with the Chinook people that were here before us and are still here and are fighting for recognition and have been for years? I think that as progressive Oregonians is something that we really need to look at very soon. Because that's kind of what it is, right? It's the structure where the U.S. acknowledges the role of the white man over all others.
Thank you, Jordan. Here is Sash and Sarah Jane.
I'm Sash, and I live in Astoria, and I was really fearful to come out today, and got some encouragement from some coworkers, and I'm feeling really good and happy to be here. There's a range of emotions for sure going through me. Fear, sadness, until probably today I didn't really believe that change could happen, but I'm feeling more hopeful than ever, which is good. So there's some joy mixed in with everything else.
Well, I think my sign is pretty simple and says what I want to say. Stop killing Black people and hold people accountable that do. And we've gotten a lot of support, which is great. You can hear it in the background. But when somebody gives me the finger holding this sign, I guess they want to continue to kill Black people. So that's about it. It's, this is, again, like, this isn't controversial. This is basic human rights. And yeah, that's it.
What do you see as the next step?
I think we need to completely rework our police system and our judicial system. I know that there are a lot of good cops out there. I know them personally. But you have to do something about the bad ones. And they need to be held to a higher standard than your average citizen. I don't know how you do it. I don't know. You can't wipe the slate clean because we can't go without them for any period of time. But everybody needs to be investigated. And if you're a good guy, prove it, you know? Stand up. Be an ally. I would love to see more of our local police here supporting us, because I'm not protesting the police. I'm protesting brutality and the killing of innocent people. That's it.